Welcome to Coffee and Literature with Eli and Todd, a high school class that is really a conversation.
About literature, not coffee. Ah, it's hot.
So this week we read One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, a book by Ken Kesey. And I actually really loved this book. I thought it was a great book. On the surface, it was just a typical American anti-hero story. But once you delve deeper into the lessons, the symbolism, and most importantly, the character development, the book is riddled with deeper meaning than one would initially guess. Really, the only reason I even noticed the lessons and deeper nuances of the book was because I was in an English class reading it, which means it must be profound and deep, right? One thing that stood out to me was the power of laughter. It's actually a quote in the book. Repeatedly, Brandon remarks how strange it is that McMurphy is laughing, but more importantly, how powerful the presence of Nurse Ratched was that some of the men hadn't laughed for years. When McMurphy barges into the ward with all his swagger, charisma, and balls, laughing, for Christ's sakes, the men are startled. Startled by the lack of action by the nurse to his laughing. The men on the ward had been scared to perceive the nurse as bigger than she really was. That was the foremost message. Never overestimate the power of your enemy. The next thing that stood out to me for whatever reason was McMurphy's boxers, black with white whales sporting red eyes, a reference to Moby Dick. One thing Todd asked me in our discussions, which came up repeatedly, was who was the whale, Nurse Ratched or Randy McMurphy? At the end of the book, the plot seems incredibly similar to the summarized plot of Moby Dick that Todd provided me. After an entire book of McMurphy pursuing his opponent, Nurse Ratched, poking and chiseling her over and over and over again until he won, Nurse Ratched authorized him to get a lobotomy, destroying any charisma, personality, or love he ever had. That was another lesson. Never underestimate the power of your enemy. Nurse Ratched destroyed his crew, his boat, everything he had. She was the whale. Flip it around, however, and McMurphy had taken her power, her dignity, her neck, and in the end, her ward. McMurphy was the whale. That was the last message. Sometimes you're the whale, and sometimes everyone is the whale. Bromden's sanity is another thing I tried to keep track of throughout the book. One way to track it was the allusion to mechanics. When he felt less like a human, when he was distressed or upset, everything around him took on mechanical properties. People were robots, having strings pulled by Nurse Ratched. Nurse Ratched was a calculated machine dedicated to manipulation and control. His confidence is also greatly attached to his sanity. One thing to track is that McMurphy makes a bet at one point that he can make Bromden bigger, and does nothing physically to change him, but boosts his confidence. In Bromden's eyes, he begins to physically grow to massive size with nothing but confidence. As Bromden's relationship with McMurphy becomes closer and more personal, two things happen. He gets more confident, and he becomes saner. It appears that Bromden has been beat down to insanity, like his sanity was in his balls, and when Nurse Ratched snipped them off, he lost it. When McMurphy gave him his balls back, he had less nightmares, less visions, and less delusions of a mechanical world controlled by the unbeatable Combine, which is what he calls the global organization against individuality, or as Gen Zers would call it, society.
Upon rereading One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I was struck by three things. The first I'd like to go into is the ability for Ken Kesey to write such a clean story. And when I mean clean, I need to say that I was always enamored with his main character, McMurphy. But this time I was more enamored by his writing style, which is straightforward. He creates a wonderful setting. He creates vivid characters. He has allusions. He has symbolism. But it's very, very clean in the sense that he's not trying to fool the reader. He's not trying to pull one over our heads or make us even dig too far. That being said, I'm a little more critical of the moral of the story, the presence of the anti-hero McMurphy, whom is obviously appealing and wonderful, vivid character. But I'm realizing more and more how much of a Beat Generation book this is. You know, the main theme being man versus society, or the individual versus society, which I get. Society can be an overwhelming presence in everyone's lives, and if we're not careful, it can make us less powerful and less strong. And that's definitely kind of a hang-up, I think, that the Boomer generation has had when in looking at their own literature, everything from Kerouac to Kesey's book here. And in that regard, I was a little less impressed than I had been in the past with the book. I also must say that the first time I read this book was in eighth grade, during a reading time during gym class. It was amazing how vividly the memories came back to me every time I read a certain paragraph, where I was exactly in eighth grade when I read the book. That being said, I want to go to the last thing, which is something that Eli picked up on, which I'm impressed, which is the power of laughter. It's where we get power. And one of the questions I asked Eli as we read this book is, at what points are people dehumanized in the story, and at what points are they rehumanized, which is McMurphy's job, especially as the martyr. And he's kind of Dionysian, definitely in this way, and it is the reckless laughter which happens, but it's also beautiful. He brought up a time with the inmates, but to me it was the moment when they were on the boat, which was the most joy in the whole story. And it was on 250, and Chief Bromden, the narrator, writes of McMurphy, "They're all laughing because he knows you have to laugh at the things that hurt you just to keep yourself in balance, just to keep the world from running you plumb crazy. He knows there's a painful side. He knows my thumb smarts, and his girlfriend has a bruised breast, and the doctor is losing his glasses. But he won't let the pain blot out the humor, no more than he'll let the humor blot out the pain." And to me, this is McMurphy's true power. It's not really so much that he is an anti-hero fighting against society. He is that person showing us that part of ourselves that can get through any problem, and that we can survive the insanity that society throws at us. So you like this book?
I did like this book, yeah. It was, unlike Faulkner, was easy to follow, but still had hints of that, you know, messing with the narration a little bit by Bromden being all kooky in the beginning, which becomes less apparent in the end because he becomes less insane, but in the beginning sometimes it's a little bit confusing what's reality and what's him freaking out about the Combine installing parts in him.
Yeah, did you pick up on that pretty quickly, that the Combine and the mechanized people and all that, and
yeah,
where Kesey was going?
Yeah,
I think we all walk through our own fog sometimes.
Definitely, yeah. And I think another important thing that stood out to me a bit was the ringing in his ears. And I didn't really keep track of where that happened, but a lot of times it was where things got silent. And I think that's where Bromden got kind of scared and uncomfortable, is when nothing was happening. Because he didn't. It's that kind of suspense. And I remember before McMurphy got angry and punched that window, there was just this insane ringing in Bromden's ears. And then he punched the window and things got into action. Things started happening and people started going, "Oh, what's going on?" And the ringing stopped.
Yeah. That's a good scene. We talked a little bit yesterday about the symbolism of that scene. I wouldn't be a good teacher of literature,
if
we didn't kind of analyze that a little bit.
Yeah.
And so I asked you what you thought the window meant yesterday, and it was definitely the climax of the battle, I think, between, well, maybe not the climax, but definitely an important moment between...
There was Orpheus. A turning point.
For sure. So what's the symbolism?
I think in that moment, McMurphy knew that if the nurse was beating him, she was beating everybody else on the ward. And I think it was kind of before that a little bit, and during that, he was beginning and finishing to realize that he loved the guys on the ward, and it was his job to stick up for them because they couldn't stick up for themselves and nobody else would. And whether that was just like a moral, you know, oh, I'm obligated to do this, or I think it was more, what else am I supposed to do?
I also think, just as an object, I like to think of story writing and in every great story that there's a sacred object. And in this story, the glass itself is symbolic of the nurse's power.
Yeah.
It separates the inmates from the insane from the sane. It's a control room in Bromden's eyes.
Yeah.
But it's also invisible. It's glass.
Yeah, you can't see it.
Right, and in feminist circles, I don't know if you've ever heard the phrase the glass ceiling.
Yeah.
Right, and that's kind of what prevents women from rising to the same power, I guess, so to speak, to men. And I think that's the case here, too. And the symbolism of McMurphy, instead of going and attacking the nurse or another inmate or a doctor or the orderlies, he goes to that glass wall and shatters it. And he does so very intentionally. In fact, he buys a bunch of cigarettes beforehand, knowing they're going to put them behind the glass. And that was his ostensible reason for breaking the glass, is that he wanted a cigarette.
Yeah.
Which is what a crazy man would do. But this is so premeditated, so thoughtful, and so symbolic, and I think he knows that. And if anything is going to frighten the nurse, it's taking away that invisible shield that protects her. And instead they put up the cardboard and she can't see them.
Yeah.
And then later, McMurphy breaks the glass again, and then later the inmates break the glass again. Every time they put in new glass, it goes out, it goes out, it goes out. And that was a turning point in the book for sure.
Absolutely.
I guess one last thing, because we're running a little short today, but you were angry with the ending yesterday. Can you say why?
Well, obviously because I like McMurphy, and obviously because I like, you know, the ragtag team of loonies that they had going and the adventures that they would go on. And then, you know, at the end of the novel, Ken Kesey just decided to ruin it all, and everybody left to different wards or just went home, and Bromden ended up killing McMurphy after he got the lobotomy, which is another important thing, but I don't think a necessary thing, but because it's there, it's important.
I think your attachment to McMurphy, which most people have, right? I mean, he's a compelling character.
I think that was the way he was designed. Everybody's supposed to care about McMurphy.
Right. But I don't think it was like a last-minute decision, like, oh, we'll just kill him. I think, you know, McMurphy becomes the martyr. He sacrifices himself for the salvation of the others.
Yeah.
And it was coming from long before. It was set up to, especially once McMurphy decided that he felt sorry for these guys. Once he realized that they were there voluntarily, he knew that they'd become small. The Combine had beaten them down. And his job was no longer to take care of himself and give himself a reduced sentence and be more comfortable and kind of a con. He breaks out of his own con to help others and becomes a true martyr. And there's a big lesson there. And, you know, I guess from a societal standpoint, do we need to have that heroic person in order to fight the Combine?
I think in a lot of instances we need that heroic person to start the movement. A lot of times when there's a Combine that needs to be fought, it's because everybody's already been beaten down. And there always needs to be someone to show everyone else that you don't have to be beat down.
Last thing I want to address, I kind of went to it a little bit in my introduction, but kind of the danger of a teacher teaching this to kids. I asked you yesterday, you know, in some ways, I'm Nurse Ratched, right? I'm the mm-hmm. authority figure in an institution. And I control what you read. I control maybe even how you interpret it. But on one level, I'm introducing you to a book with an anti-hero that makes society look bad, or at least demonstrates some of its dangers.
Mm-hmm.
I equate it to teaching Nietzsche to college freshmen. It's very can be seen as dangerous and frightening if it's taken on a superficial level. And I guess the question for you is, as appealing as McMurphy is, could you ever see yourself becoming or being a McMurphy?
I have been a McMurphy for as long as I can remember. And I really don't say that in a bragging way. When I was about 4, I was diagnosed with oppositional defiance disorder, which okay. is probably the best way to summarize what is wrong with McMurphy. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's just I defy people and things to the point where it's a disorder, where it disrupts my daily life. And it's not a good thing. And, you know, I think as of late, having authority issues has been some sort of, you know, trendy thing, you know. I think, like, you know, some aspects of punk are coming back and stuff like that. And it's not glorious having authority issues coming from someone who's diagnosed with authority issues. It's painful. It really is. Because I can feel the pain that McMurphy is in while he goes through this, because he knows, he's like, God, this is going to be the end of me, you know? But there's nothing else that he can do. And usually that stuff is running through my mind as I'm telling a substitute teacher to, you know, F off, and that she's being a lot of bad words. And, you know, usually I say that, and as I'm saying it, I'm like, God, this is bad. Then after it, I'm like, oh no, I did that. And, you know, that's kind of, I can see that running through McMurphy's head, but it's premeditated. Mm. And McMurphy has a cause for it. He knows that he has to do it. I, on the other hand, never have to do it.
Yeah.
But it's, I think there's,
If we step outside the kind of romanticism of the anti-hero and the martyr, yeah. which is not just a beat literature thing. I mean, martyrdom goes way back, right? But if we step outside that and look at it kind of rationally and coldly, as a Stoic might, we can say McMurphy lost. He lost his life.
Yeah.
And maybe it's better to toe the line.
I don't think there's anyone in the book who didn't lose. And that's the way things usually go for me when I do that sort of thing.
Well, then this is a new moral for us. It's not the superficial one in the book and the notion of the rugged individual versus society. Maybe the bigger question from this book is, what does winning look like?
Yeah, absolutely. And is it worth it to lose? What is worth losing?
Yeah, the moment on the boat is why I liked it. It was a moment of winning.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then the seas got rough again, the storm came up, and
And McMurphy and Billy died.
Yeah. Bromden got away.
Yeah.
So maybe that's winning. Maybe. Through the fields.
Yeah, and one thing that I can't decide is, did Bromden lose or win? Because he lost in the sense that he lost his best friend. Mm-hmm. And most, like, every other friend he had, no one was left for him. But he got away. So is that winning or losing, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. Big theme.
Indeed.
Well, thank you. Good book. I enjoyed reading it with you.
I did as well.
Alrighty. Alright, we'll see you tomorrow. We'll do a final podcast about the class in general and see where we go.
Woohoo. Till next time.
Todd and Eli.
Out.